Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is the biggest economy in the world, right? More purchasing power than anywhere else on the planet. So why is it that American companies that want to make money have to do it overseas? Corporate profits are going to get us going today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand homeowner reviews on local contractors like plumbers, painters, and movers. Details at angieslist.com. And by gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. Today is the 21st of April. We call it a season, as in earnings season. Once every 3 months, corporate America opens its books and lets us have a peek inside. It's not always pretty in there. Exhibit A would be the financial stocks we spent some time on last week. That trend continued today, by the way, with Bank of America posting a 77% drop in profits. But a good number of other industries, from drugs to toys, have been doing all right. What do they have in common, I hear you ask? Customers overseas. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
Hasbro games, like Monopoly and Candyland, have been favorites of American kids for generations. Hasbro also owns some of the hottest new brands around, like the Transformers action figures, based on last fall's hit movie. But about half the company's business happens overseas.
That's clearly one of their intents, not only to build a strong business in the key markets in Europe, but as I say, to develop emerging areas such as South America and Asia.
Analyst Margaret Whitfield follows Hasbro. The company's overseas revenue jumped 22% this quarter, while earnings at home actually dropped 18%. Drug maker Merck also did well this quarter, thanks in part to its overseas business. Other companies have too. Noel Lamb is chief investment officer for Russell Investments Group. He says it's hard to generalize since industries like pharmaceuticals and toys are so different. But he says one thing is true. The economy almost everywhere is growing faster than in the U.S. and will for a while yet, which is good for American companies operating abroad. And right now, those companies get an added bonus.
With the weak dollar, those companies who have a large percent of their revenues coming from overseas are those which are likely to do better than purely domestic-focused companies.
That's because everything that's sold in, say, euros ends up being worth a lot more dollars when it's translated back onto an American balance sheet. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
About those banks I mentioned, it's not just giants like Citigroup and Washington Mutual that are having trouble. Ohio-based National City said today it's going to have to raise $7 billion worth of new capital. It's not like National's some small regional player either. It's the 10th largest bank in the country. But today's news is just one more indicator that the credit crunch isn't done with us just yet. National is going to get its money from private equity firms and hedge funds that know a buying opportunity when they see it. Ashley Milne-Tite explains now how the mortgage crisis is moving to Main Street.
Analysts say there's plenty to love about National City despite the $171 million loss it posted today. Bart Nato with consulting firm Celent says take retail banking or wholesale lending, for instance. They're doing just fine. The mortgage business, on the other hand.
That is dragging down the results of the entire bank. These private investors are seeing that there is value to the other pieces of the bank, and they're picking up on that value and hope to generate superior returns because of it.
He says this isn't the start of a domino effect of smaller regional banks seeking bailouts. He says National City, a super regional out of Cleveland, is in trouble because of its exposure to bad mortgages. Many smaller banks, he says, are far less exposed to the mortgage business. Bert Ely is a banking consultant and Ohio native. He says today's announcement isn't great news for shareholders, but...
My assumption is that the board of directors of National City concluded that as low as this price is, it's still a better deal for the company stockholders than if the bank was sold today.
He says he's pretty impressed the bank has managed to raise as much as $7 billion.
It's a testament to the bank's going forward strength as a banking business and by extension to the U.S. banking industry in general.
which he says has been dragged down too much by the problems of investment banks and mortgage companies. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Staying with banks here for a second, the Bank of England has taken a page from Ben Bernanke's handbook. Today, the B of E announced new rules that will let banks over there swap their mortgage-backed bonds for the good stuff, that is, UK Treasury bills. It's about $100 billion worth of new liquidity. So far, just in case you're curious, the U.S. Fed has pumped about $350 billion into the banking system here. And then there was oil. As of today, $117.83 a barrel is the official record price. Crude closed at $117.48 in New York. A couple of things going on to drive that. There was an attack on a pipeline in Nigeria today. There's a refinery strike in Scotland. And there was a meeting today in Rome. The International Energy Forum lets both buyers and sellers talk about how much oil should cost without getting all caught up in the emotions of the marketplace. It stands to reason that countries that have oil would be trying to increase production so that they can cash in on those prices, right? But that is not the case, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Saudi Arabia is in the midst of expanding oil production by 11% to meet rising demand from Asia. Some forecasts predict global demand will grow by 30% over the next 5 years, but Saudi Arabia has no plans to boost production further.
In terms of what investment is planned and what investment is scheduled, they have their work cut out for them, just keeping up with the demand growth that's expected.
That's Tom Wallen, president of Energy Intelligence. He says Saudi Arabia and other OPEC members are wary of expanding production in the face of a U.S. recession.
They don't want to make these big investments in new capacity until they're sure or they have reasonable confidence that there's going to be demand for them.
Oil producers remember the late 90s when the economic meltdown in Asia reduced demand for energy and caused oil prices to crash. Paul Roberts is the author of The End of Oil. He doesn't expect the bottom will fall out.
We'll definitely see oil cresting at 120. And I guess the question is, how much higher does it go?
Robert says there comes a point when investors begin to question why Saudi Arabia does not increase production.
If prices continue to go up and they don't bring new production online to help ease those prices, the markets are going to begin to assume that they can't bring production online.
And if the markets perceive that Saudi Arabia can't increase production, suggesting that its oil reserves are not as vast as imagined, that sense of scarcity could spur speculators to the point where $117 a barrel starts to sound like a bargain. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Don't give up all hope about those oil prices. I saw today June oil futures are trading at about $110. Of course, that was for June 09, so these prices are going to be with us for a while. If you're trying to game the equities markets, here's a helpful tidbit from the New York Stock Exchange. The NYSE said today what are called short interest sales ticked up last week. Short sellers are those who bet an index or an individual stock is going to go down. How reliable an indicator is it, really? Not so much. In regular trading today, kind of a mixed bag. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Boeing's among the companies analysts will be watching this week. The airplane maker is one of the 30 Dow industrials. It reports first quarter earnings Wednesday, middle of the day sometime. Last Friday, the company said it's considering changes to its pension program. It'll consider offering new hires 401ks instead of more traditional pension plans. Probably won't help profits in the short run, but in time it could save some money. Commentator and economist Peter Lindert's been thinking about retirement. He says for all the talk about a Social Security crisis, the real problem is with those private pensions.
The ongoing debate over Social Security has it all wrong. Our basic retirement problem does not center on Social Security or on pay-as-you-go or on defined benefit plans. Our real retirement problem is more private, more fundamental. Our private job-related pension plans are exposed to multiple risks. Employer default, dips in asset markets, inflation, low interest rates, and recession. Just diversifying your private portfolio can't eliminate all these risks, especially not if they all happen at once, as they threaten to do right now. Yes, some of us have the helpful Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation to fall back on, but the PBGC itself has lost reserves since 2001. If more employers start canceling pensions as if they were air flights, the pension defaults could wipe out the PBGC reserves faster than you can say savings and loan. So where are the safe havens, if not in your job-based plan? You cannot just retreat into individual savings. True, if you save more take-home pay, it looks better than employer contributions to pensions. But your own nest egg still has multiple risks, with no safety net if your investments go sour. Worse yet, regardless of how you save, you face the danger of a long life. We can't all work less than 4 decades and retire for more than 20 years. Something has to give. The good news is other countries have come up with political compromises that protect public pensions against economic and demographic risks. Sweden and other countries now protect their defined benefit system with what are called notional individual accounts. This means they fix the share of national income paid in public pension benefits and the overall account's balance. The tax rate for public pensions never changes, and your retirement benefits move with the nation's income. As a generation lives longer, its retirees get a lower share of taxpayers' money each year, but for more years. If only our private pension plans worked that well. Of course, there's always Social Security.
Peter Lindert is a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis. His latest book is called Growing Public. Send us your thoughts about what Professor Lindert had to say or about anything else you hear on the broadcast. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. Your average Hollywood blockbuster doesn't hit the break-even point until somewhere well past $140 million. But over in France, a low-budget comedy with no big-name stars and no real marketing budget at all has pulled in that much in just 7 weeks. That makes it the most successful French film of all time, economically, anyway. Critics say the response to its feel-good message is a backlash against President Nicolas Sarkozy's flamboyance. Editorials are calling it a small-town triumph in the age of globalization. John Lawrenson reports from Paris.
Some of the 18 million French people who've paid to see Welcome to the Land of the Ch'ti. It's about a post office director who's under pressure from his wife to get a transfer to the Riviera, so he fakes a disability. When he's found out, he's sent instead to the northernmost tip of France, the district called simply and chillingly
Le Nord.
The North. A little visited corner of France with a reputation for rain, economic failure and alcoholism. People there speak an impenetrable dialect where they don't say S, they say SH, which is why they're called the Ch'ti, the people who say SH. But our hero, bald and getting on a bit like an extraordinary number of current French movie heroes, falls in love with the place and its simple but generous inhabitants. It's about ordinary people, and ordinary French people love it.
You come out of the cinema feeling great. I love it when you can get up close and discover how people live, what they're really like with their qualities and their faults, which in the end aren't really faults at all. It's just life.
For France's president, who'd like very much his people to be more ambitious and run faster in the rat race, the message is not encouraging. Judging by the success of the Ch'ti, the French are in the grips of a deep, rather nostalgic hankering after the simple things in life, like friendship and getting drunk. And, says Anne Fulda, movie critic with the Figaro newspaper, its success is a rejection of the corporate movie-making machine.
Les gens n'ont plus envie des succès qu'on leur impose, je pense.
People don't want the choice of what's going to be a hit film made for them. They don't like it when they're told a film costs a fortune with stars that were paid a fortune, so it has to be a hit. They feel they're being taken for granted.
Asterix at the Olympic Games, a star-studded comedy that cost $123 million, the most expensive French movie of all time, and the film everyone expected to be the big hit in 2008. But the French, grappling with globalization, preferred to go and see a post office director falling in love with a town where the economy's weak, but local identity's strong. Executive producer Eric Hubert says the Ch'ti works because the writer, director and co-star, Danny Boone, is from the north of France. He is a Ch'ti. Welcome to the Land of the Ch'ti is still looking for a distributor in the States, but already Hollywood producers are thinking about buying the concept and transposing it, says Hubert. It might work, he says, with a New Yorker in Texas, if the person writing it is from there and loves the place. In the meantime, the Ch'ti is set to break another record and beat the most successful American movie to play in France, Titanic. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Coming up, an economist forecasts trouble.
Not only are we currently on an unsustainable trajectory, whether it's in climate or water or land use or global population growth, but things are getting worse.
But first, let's do the numbers. Kind of a mixed picture today. The Dow Industrials fell 24 points, about 0.2% to finish at 12,825. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, 0.2% there as well to end at 2408. The S&P 500 trimmed 2 points, about 0.1% there. Wound up the day at 1388. Bank of America lost 2.5%. National City tumbled more than 27%. Today, Sears offloaded almost 7%. Bank of America said it's not going to renew a $1 billion line of credit. Eli Lilly slipped 4.75%. The maker of psychiatric drugs didn't meet analysts' expectations. Overseas, European markets lost a little ground. Tokyo's Nikkei gained 1.6%. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist, committed to writing about issues that matter and the connections between them. The Economist, see the world differently. At newsstands and economist.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management. Online at shrm.org. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for March. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses the role of credit rating agencies in the nation's credit problems. And events around the world mark Earth Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The first quarter is not usually a strong one for toy companies. There's that post-Christmas lull and all. Earnings from the world's two largest toy makers came in as a split decision today. Hasbro came ready to play. Profits were up 14% over a year ago. Sales of Barbie didn't do a thing for number one Mattel. That helped generate a first quarter loss. Ironically, as we were talking about earlier, both companies did better selling overseas than they did here at home. Mattel's global supply chain, though, did cause it some pain. It's still dealing with last year's lead paint recall of toys made in China. But toy makers aren't the only ones who buy parts and products they sell here overseas. Businesses save tons of money doing that, all kinds of businesses. But sometimes they're buying worries, too, from tainted pet food to poisonous toothpaste. And that has some companies working on ethical supply chains. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports.
At the headquarters of Reebok, Greg Niebel's job is to control the foreign factories that churn out his company's sneakers, sweatpants, and ball caps.
Hello?
Hey, Julian, buenos tardes. Estoy Greg aquí, ¿cómo estás?
Niebel's team is working with officials in Mexico to make sure suppliers there meet Reebok standards for fair wages and worker safety.
Which of the two cameras gave him that information, do you know? Yeah. Okay.
Niebel says his job gets harder each day because Reebok and its parent company Adidas rely on foreign manufacturers more than ever.
Ignorance is bliss. The more we learn, the more complicated it's become, the more you realize the things that you don't know and don't understand.
Reebok got a hard lesson in that 2 years ago in a product safety case. A four-year-old died after swallowing a charm bracelet that accompanied a pair of shoes his parents bought. Turns out Reebok's Chinese supplier made the bracelet out of lead. There was a major recall, a settlement with the family, and last month Reebok paid a $1 million fine to U.S. regulators. Niebel says his company takes the fall when foreign contractors screw up.
Yeah, it's a reality. But we don't try and make excuses from that, you know. Just because we don't employ the workers in those factories doesn't mean that we're outsourcing our responsibilities.
But babysitting suppliers is expensive. Reebok spends millions overseeing its product chain, and other companies are just now realizing they'd better too.
That's often the case with corporate America. You don't act until it is a crisis.
Matt Kelly is the editor of Compliance Week magazine. He says global supply chains are great for making products more cheaply, but Kelly says they also turn tiny mistakes into huge problems overnight.
It's not as if you're going to set up a small shop in China and manufacture a few hundred widgets and then see if things work. You're going to set up something big. It's going to cost you millions. You'll have thousands and thousands of products, and then you find out there's a big problem. And now you're stuck because now you have a very big hole that you have to dig yourself out of.
It used to be so simple when foreign suppliers just made T-shirts and trinkets. Now it's everything from mouthwash to airplane parts. With recent product scares, CEOs are now rolling up their sleeves, doing the work that was normally relegated to some deputy vice president for risk assessment. Adidas CEO Herbert Heiner says in the end, he has to cross his fingers and hope that his company has thought of everything that could go wrong.
I do believe that we do whatever is necessary to avoid things like that where shoes are poisoned or whatsoever. And so I feel relatively comfortable. But you never know. I mean, when you're working around the world in over 120 countries where we are, you cannot control the last corner in the world.
But the simple fact is companies have to try to. Global supply chains are here to stay. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
This is going to sound a little counterintuitive, but I'd guess food analysts are hoping the Commodities Futures Trading Commission comes up with some evidence of a conspiracy at a hearing it's holding tomorrow. The commission's going to be looking into why grain prices are so high and how much of those record prices are due to speculation. If it's simply supply and demand, then that suggests they could be around much longer term than we'd thought. In the past month or so, some of the world's poorest consumers in Africa and Asia have rioted over the rising price of wheat and rice. Columbia University economist Jeffrey Sachs says that's no surprise, really. In his latest book, Commonwealth, Sachs says unless we cut back on consumption, we'd better get used to food riots and skyrocketing energy prices.
Not only are we currently on an unsustainable trajectory, whether it's in climate or water or land use or global population growth, but things are getting worse. The pressures that we're putting on the world's systems will multiply tremendously until we understand that we need a different approach.
This is a time, though, of a unified global economy, but a sharply divided global society. How do you get there from here?
The point is that if we understand that we share common problems, that Phoenix and the west of the United States is facing climate change and drying, the same way that Pakistan and Tehran and the Sahel of Africa are facing climate change and drying, then we can start thinking together and working together on truly common interests. The chance to work together would be grasped with tremendous excitement and enthusiasm in so many parts of the world.
Who do they want help from, though? Do they want it from the United States or don't they care?
Well, I think the idea that the U.S. is the leader of these problems or solutions is passé. My book doesn't call for the United States to assume the global leadership role. We need cooperation with China. China now emits more greenhouse gases than we do. China's demand for a growing food supply puts pressures in all parts of the world. So this is simply a call to say, let's look at the problem systematically, look at the technologies, because that's where I put the focus. Understand that the costs of solutions are much less than people fear, and then work together to implement.
Is there a prescriptive remedy? Can we sit here and say, listen, we need to do this about climate change, this about population, this about poverty, and this about politics, and then presto?
We don't know everything that will need to be done because there's going to be a lot of exploration and learning along the way. But on climate change, for instance, we can understand fully that at the core of the climate change problem is the transition to a sustainable energy system. That means converting to new technologies, whether it's concentrated solar thermal in the Mojave Desert or whether it's plug-in hybrids or some other high-mileage technology for automobiles. We can't say exactly which of these options or which combination, for that matter, will be the ones that will prove to be the least cost and the most scalable. But we know a lot about what's within reach and then the kinds of systems that need to be put in place to get them adopted.
Seems to me what you're asking for here, what you're calling for, is a series of global public investments. Where's the dividing line between the public sector responsibility and corporate America and corporate Europe and corporate Asia?
The nature of major technological change is that there must be the broad participation of many different parts of society. So we need academia. We need large-scale government financing for the basic science and for early-stage demonstration. We need the private sector, which does one marvelous thing. When the price is right and the technology is close to demonstration or demonstrated, it can scale up remarkably if the market incentives are put in place.
Jeffrey Sachs is the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's a special advisor to the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. His latest book is called Commonwealth: Economics for a Crowded Planet. Professor Sachs, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you for having me on the show today.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note to wrap things up today, the Beijing Auto Show is this week. Pretty much every car maker on the planet's there trying to get a toehold. And Detroit's Big Three might actually have an edge in this one. Analysts point out bigger is by far better in the world's biggest car market. SUV sales in China are expected to grow by as much as 40% this year. And in a nod to today's record oil prices, there is word out of Detroit that hybrid sales are up. Registrations in the U.S. for new hybrids rose 38% last year. Catch is the total number of them is still only about 2% of all the cars on U.S. roads. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 24 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq rose 5 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 lost 2 points. That's 0.1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, listing a new way to do business.
What better way to operate is there than to just follow up on what your customers or users are asking for and to just block out everything else?
It's another conversation from the corner office, this time with Craigslist CEO Jim Buckmaster. You get it? Listing a new way to do business? I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.